Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice. Hello, today I'm here with Miranda Seymour, author of award-winning memoir In My Father's House. Miranda has written many acclaimed novels and biographies, including Lives of Mary Shelley, Robert Graves, Ottilie Morel, and Helénice, the Bugatti Queen. She divides her time between London and her ancestral home in Nottinghamshire. But we're here today to talk about her latest book, Noble Endeavours, The Life of Two Countries, England and Germany in Many Stories. Hello, Miranda. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, Josephine. Lovely to be here.
So why the subject England and Germany?
An enormous subject. And looking back, I don't know why I ever embarked on such an enormous thing, because it's been 5 years in the making. I started off with the idea of doing a book about the appeasers in the 30s. And pretty much the appeasers were the people who were very eager to keep Hitler quiet. They felt very bad about the Treaty of Versailles. They felt that Germany had been given a rough ride, and really anything that happened in Germany was repeatedly, they said, not our affair. And that was appeasing. Mm-hmm. So they were the ones who were really allowing Hitler to do what he did and allowing him to think that England would support Hitler and would never go to war. So the book started with the idea of being about them. And pretty soon I started to think, well, why were these people appeasing? What was it that had made them so desperate to get on well with Germany, which took me back to the Treaty of Versailles? And then, what do you know, it just went back and back and back. And the more I look back, the more I thought, this is quite extraordinary that we now have a country where in England, I think 3 years ago, 2010, we had 830 books published about the Third Reich, and all sort of very much focusing on the worst of Germany. And yet once we were as close as a brother and sister to each other. And so I decided that I would do a book which would be a much huger endeavour, which would portray the friendship between the two countries right back from 1613, when, I know, a long, long, long way back, certainly not where I expected to go back to, which was when the very beautiful woman who became the Winter Queen, Elizabeth, married the Elector Palatine of Germany.
And she was English.
She was English, and she was a princess. Mm. And the idea was that she was going to ally England, a quite fragile new Protestant country, feeling deeply insecure about being Protestant, with a hugely Roman Catholic Europe, needed an ally. And so that's really where the alliance began. And sweetly enough, Elizabeth and her lovely Elector Palatine, who was a very handsome young man, felt completely in love. And this felt like a very nice moment to start the whole story with John Donne writing a lovely poem about the marriage of the Thames and the Rhine. And I thought, well, that's where it should begin.
Our royal family are German, aren't they?
Well, that was a thing which I sort of knew, as we all do, but I hadn't quite taken in. I'd sort of learnt it in history at school, of course. But the fact that it was Elizabeth the Winter Queen's niece, who was the Electress of Hanover, who was going to be the first German ruler of England. And in the end, she died while walking out in her garden at the age of about 91. She would have actually made a great ruler for England, I think. And so George I, her son, came over instead. But when one thinks of it going all the way back to then, when you've got a German who didn't even speak English coming over with his entire German court, all the way down to Victoria, I was so surprised by this. I knew that Victoria and Albert were a love match, but I hadn't realised that behind doors they would always speak German together. And that when Victoria went out to Germany, it's quite telling. She said, it's so wonderful to find people speaking German out in public, where, you know, it's perfectly natural for them to speak. And one suddenly realises that she was only able to speak it in private to her husband.
Yeah, because apparently even her children, who were brought up in England, they had German accents because their parents obviously had spoken German.
Well, that was another extraordinary thing, was that Edward VII had a thick German accent, the Prince of Wales, whereas the Kaiser, his cousin, who absolutely adored Victoria, and he was the oldest grandson, and he had this passion for England. And he spoke superb English with no accent whatsoever. And when he came over here, the people would adore him because he could kind of crack jokes with a Cockney, and he loved dressing up in the English uniforms. They all regarded him as one of their own.
Fantastic. So interesting. Do you have a personal connection with Germany, Miranda?
I do, and this was part of the fascination for me of doing the book, that, well, my own sense of Germany not being a part of my life was that when I was a little girl, about 11 years old, I went to stay with one of my favourite cousins in Norfolk, and my cousin Jane said in an excited whisper, "We've got a German staying this weekend." And we were both incredibly excited. And it turned out he was actually very glamorous. He was called Franzi von Stauffenberg, but we didn't know, you know, about the Stauffenberg family or Stauffenberg plot. We just knew that he was a gorgeous young man, very, very, very shy, and blushed furiously whenever we looked at him. And German to Jane and I was so other that even to touch Franz's arm felt thrillingly something you couldn't do. And that's how much Germany was not a part of my life. But despite this, in 1934, my 11-year-old mother had gone out to Munich just after the night of the Long Knives and all the assassinations in Munich when Hitler supervised the killing of many of his leaders. And this was just 1 month later that my mother went out with all her sisters and her mother and father to attend the wedding of her older brother John to Nutzi Harrach, who came from a very anti-Nazi family who lived in the centre of Munich. And I asked my mother when I was writing the book, and I said, "What can you remember?" And of course, typically of an old lady, she said, "Well, I had a lovely grey silk tussore coat, and I had a very, very nice little red hat." And I said, "Yes, and what then else? What? And what else?" And then eventually, seeing me looking a bit plaintive, she said, "Well, what I do remember was the sound every morning when I woke up of the clack of the heels, the metal heels of the Gestapo marching on the pavements," which was quite a frisson. And also a detail which did fascinate me, and this was just after this massacre, when they were broadcasting to Germany, Hitler and Goebbels and people, that they had done the right thing and this was good. And my mother said that on every street corner, there was an enormous megaphone on a lamppost. And again, in the morning, she would hear this voice, which I would guess was probably Hitler's voice, blaring out across the streets, telling the Germans what was good for them.
So literally being brainwashed.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But you see, when I looked at the pictures of my mother and her sisters and the German family together, it was incredibly poignant, because what I saw was the most enchanting picture of a happy wedding. There was not a Nazi uniform in sight. There were just two very happy families, all delightful. The bride's father was a sculptor, and his mother was a rather remarkable woman who was a poet and a painter. And they were very kind of civilized, bohemian, and very, very, very anti-Hitler.
So now, being very, very anti-Hitler, was that dangerous? I mean, did they get into trouble in the war?
Well, they were quite privileged, because I think partly because old Countess Harrach was from a very grand family, and Hitler was very loath to move against the grand families. He wanted to kind of get them on his side and not to be seen to be acting against them. So as far as I can make out, Countess Harrach's nightly activity, which was to go around Munich ripping down all the posters of the Nazis, they just turned a blind eye. But what she was able to do, because they were privileged, was that her eldest daughter had married somebody with a wonderful castle called Niederarnbach, just outside Munich. And they were able to retreat into this castle with a moat around it. It really was isolated. And just stay out of it. But I think for anybody less lucky than that, there was always this terror of being overheard, and it was very difficult not to be implicated.
Your mother's brother came back to England with a German wife.
Well, this really fascinates me.
What year was that then, 1930?
They came back in 1934,
yeah,
after the wedding, and they moved to and fro until 1939 between Munich and England. And nothing ever happened to them. But what interested me, well, two or three things interested me. One was that my Aunt Nutzi was able to spend the entire war holed up in the castle that my grandfather owned, where he rented it, called Chirk Castle in Wales. And nothing ever happened to her. She was allowed to work with the English Red Cross and then with Dr. Barnardo's and so on and so on. And she even apparently had a private line through to Winston Churchill, who had said, if anything goes wrong, just call me. Well, there is the fact that, I mean, I've seen the photographs. She was the most beautiful woman, and beautiful in a charming way, with sort of long flaxen hair looking a bit like Rapunzel. And perhaps Winston Churchill was just bewitched out of his wits.
But everybody else was in turn, so I don't understand how she got away with it.
I think she got away with it because she was a very beautiful young woman. She was living in a castle in Wales, and it did interest me that both in that war, in the Second War and in the First War, Welsh families were able to hide Germans away. There was another family in the First War who'd done the same thing with a young prince who'd been on a submarine, a German submarine, and I think the daughter knew him a bit, so they just hid him away.
Maybe
in Wales.
Maybe because it literally, Wales, you know, then communications wasn't as strong. It literally, it was like in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly.
They were lost in a way.
Exactly. I think they felt it just wasn't worth bothering about.
Yeah.
And so if any more people had known it, all they needed to do was go to Wales and they might have been better off. But in contrast to that, one of the other characters in my book who I became very enchanted by was the son of Daisy Pless, an Englishwoman, and Hansel, who was half German, half English. Although he fought in the First World War for Germany and the Second War, he'd by the mid-30s come over to England, hated the Gestapo. And because he was the son of a great coal family in Germany and very much on the borders of Poland, when war first broke out, Winston Churchill thought, I will consult Hansel Pless because he will know what's going on in Poland because all the Pless estates were on the border. So this is the extraordinary thing. On practically the first night that war broke out, Hansel Pless was sitting down to dinner with Winston Churchill, advising him about Poland. And within 2 years, no, sorry, not even 2 years, by 1940 in the summer, Hansel had asked if he could have a proper job in the army. He was passionately patriotic about England. Oh. Instead of which, he was taken off to Brixton Prison and interned for 3 years, and not nearly as nicely as the Mosleys. I mean, he had a straw pallet and a desk, and that was it.
Why did they overnight change their mind then?
1940 summer was when suddenly the rule about internment came in and England hardened its policy and Churchill decided no more fun and games. But what my point really is, it's very interesting that there was one rule for my beautiful Aunt Nutschi, completely German, and another rule completely for the completely innocent and in the end entirely vindicated Hansel Pless.
Terrible, terrible. There's nothing good about war, is there? You say that historically we're more than political allies, but we share a culture. Culturally, I mean, I think of them as, well, I suppose they're beer swilling and we are. They like sausages and we are, but what else?
What I found was that, again, going right back in time, you found that a lot of the more intense English, it always seems to have been the ones who are very thoughtful and, if you like, more Germanic, people like Coleridge, for example, went over to Germany to discover about German thought and German poetry and German culture. And Coleridge, to take a good example, arrived in Germany having left his young wife and children in England. And I think for two pins he would never have come back again. He just found that it was congenial and this rather high-minded attitude, if you like, and thoughtfulness and readiness to talk about intellectual things, which was not English at all, suited a particular kind of English mind. So for Coleridge, it was wonderful. But then if you hop forward a bit, you get to Goethe. Now, Goethe's hero, believe it or not, was Byron. He had a huge, absolutely hideous bust of Byron stuck up in his study. And anybody who came to visit Goethe in Weimar was asked to admire this wonderful bust and to agree that the greatest poet in the world was Byron. So that was Goethe towards Byron, who was, you know, the great poet of Europe too. But Byron had no interest in going to Germany, never went near it. It was just a one-way thing.
Mm-hmm. So you think that we've looked to each other kind of poetically, musically as well?
Yes.
Think about they're brilliant at music.
The musical thing. Well, on the intellectual thing, another thing that I realised was that so many of the people in England were either Catholics or they weren't Protestant. They were from almost any other religion, Quaker or Catholic. And for anybody like that, to get a good education was impossible in England because you weren't allowed to go to university. So they went
you
to Germany.
You
no, 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 they
had to be C of E.
Yep, absolutely. And so all the Quakers, which is why there's an enormous group of Quakers in Germany who became incredibly important during the 30s and getting Jews out of Germany, mm-hmm. and were really the great unsung heroes of those years, and the Catholics, they all went out there and acquired the most superb education in Germany. So there was that side of it, the intellectual side. And the musical side, and there are wonderful characters that I've written about, like Ethel Smythe and Mary Portman. But
Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Ethel Smythe, going chronologically, was a marvellous, eccentric English woman composer in the days when women composers barely existed in England, certainly weren't recognised.
So when was this around?
This is really in the 1870s.
Wow.
And Ethel came from a thoroughly unmusical family, and she had a great gift. She wrote some really wonderful operas. Ethel Smythe was a superb English woman composer who realised that the best musical training to be got was out in Leipzig, which is where all the great composers went to, and where she found people like Brahms and Tchaikovsky even. And she went out there and learnt a lot about German music, became very influenced by it. But what really attracted her about Germany was something, again, I knew nothing about, which was that in England, you just rattled through a quick performance and then bingo, your opera was on stage. Whereas the Germans would really, as you would imagine, do it properly and seriously, and there was lots and lots and lots of rehearsal, which as the composer is what you would want. Mm-hmm. So Ethel was determined that her operas were first going to be heard in Germany. And it was actually rather heartbreaking, because when her first opera, Der Wald, came out in Germany, it was when the Boer War was causing a lot of wrath in the German minds, because, you know, the German-Boer link was very strong, and they felt very upset. So I'm afraid her opera got booed. Nothing to do with poor Ethel.
Yeah.
But alack and alas, her great opera, The Wreckers, which is quite often played today, it was going to be performed in 1914. Exactly.
Bad timing.
Yeah. And the other very poignant musical figure to me was a woman about whom almost nothing is known, called Mary Portman. And Mary was the daughter of somebody called Lord Portman, who was very rich.
Portman Square,
exactly, the Portman estate, and he owned the house that became Bryanston School. Anyway, stupendously rich.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary was a violinist, and she begged and beseeched her parents to let her not go on the driven course for a young aristocrat. She didn't just want to marry a peer and have a nice country house. She wanted to go and find music in Germany. So she followed Ethel Smythe out to Leipzig. Mm. And then, because she was very rich, she went to Bavaria, and she decided that in Bavaria, in 1913, she would create, at a time when it was very obvious that war was looming and almost inescapable, that she would somehow avert it by creating a beautiful house of music. And there was a very touching story told to me just by an old couple I met out there, of a grandfather who had met Mary wandering through a beautiful meadow under the Alps. And he saw this rather stocky little figure in her alpenstock and boots and everything, suddenly gazing as though she'd been transfixed. And she said, "Here is my spot." And this was the spot where she began to build the Portman House, which was going to be where musicians from England and Germany would come together and make music, and somehow peace would be achieved.
Wonderful.
It was wonderful, except what happened was Mary got the builders in, and the building started to be built, and it's actually there today as part of a wonderful big hotel called the Kranzbach. But Mary never saw that, because the war broke out and all the money in banks was frozen. So the builders couldn't be paid because Mary couldn't get hold of the money. So they put her in prison. Her father had to somehow get a route through the American ambassador, because America wasn't in the war, to get her out.
Yeah.
And Mary was so distraught by the whole thing that she never went back. And the Portman House was built with her designs, without her. And that she never saw her dream come true.
Was it turned into a musical place, or just turned into a hotel?
Sadly not. No, it became, no. I mean, it still is a place that could be a wonderful musical place, and I think it would be rather lovely if it was that. But actually what it is the most gorgeous spa in the Alps. But it is called the Portman House, and they're terribly proud of the connection.
follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah. Now let's go back to Daisy Pless, because she was Cornwallis West, which is a famous kind of English family. She had an ambitious mother, and you said that she married her off to this coal prince in the 1890s. And she was quite radical and left-wing. Can you tell us why?
Daisy's a figure who's been really written out of history because she wrote memoirs. And there was a kind of upper-class woman of the, I don't know, between, say, 1890 to 1940, who wrote things called names like, you know, All That Glitters Is Not Gold, or My Royal Coronet, or things like that.
Corny things.
You know, there's awful things. And I think somewhere, Cecil Beaton actually did an incredibly funny takeoff of one of these books and wrote a spoof with himself dressed up as one of these old ladies, which is a marvellous takeoff. But Daisy was not of that ilk at all. Daisy was a beautiful, spirited young girl who'd grown up in Wales, very close to all the Welsh coal mines. And so when she went out to her husband's estates on the edge of Poland in Silesia and saw her family, her new family, living in tremendous splendour. I mean, the Kaiser moved into one of the Pless houses as his eastern headquarters during the war. And apparently he chose it because it was the place that was nearest to being in the Ritz in Paris. Wow. Unbelievable. But Daisy looked at what was lying in the valleys below the Pless castles, and she was horrified. She saw dreadful little sort of tenement buildings and slum conditions, and she was told by her husband that the miners were really very lucky because they came up to have tea at the castle once a year. And Daisy lost her temper and said, yes, indeed, they come up to tea once a year because they have to, because you order them to. It's a 2-hour slog up the hill. They then wait in the dark for 2 hours for you and your father to appear, and they slog off back down to the slums. That's not good enough. And so spirited was she that she got the prince's father completely on her side. And he said, you're right. And between them, the old prince and Daisy set a huge reform scheme in motion, which became the most admired scheme in Silesia and actually set an example for all of Germany to copy, of a new way of treating the miners so they got better paid, helping lace makers, providing better housing. And even in the war, Daisy set up special hospitals for people.
Fantastic. So she stayed in Germany in the war?
She didn't have an option. Mm. If you were in Germany when the war broke out, you couldn't get out. And for Daisy, it was very hard, hard for anybody like that, because, of course, all her English friends were over there in POW camps. But the minute Daisy went to visit them, everybody said, she's a spy, she's a spy, she's getting messages out, look at what she's doing.
Now, why wasn't she put in a POW camp?
She wasn't, well, partly because she was the Princess Pless and she was very, very grand. And also, remember, the Kaiser was living in her husband's house.
Okay, so she sort of waved.
I think the Kaiser couldn't really live in her house and put Daisy in a camp. On the whole, women like that were not put in camps. There wasn't an internment system for those kind of people. They were just expected to be quiet and lie very low indeed. And either a lot of the poor English-German women who'd come over with, you know, a German husband and had to come back to Germany ended up living in a kind of purgatory in these smart hotels, which were like sort of enormous caravanserais of exiles. Not such a terrible fate, but not much fun either. Yeah. Daisy's story is pretty heartbreaking because she had, in the pictures of Daisy, just break your heart. She was so beautiful and so spirited and such fun, and everybody loved her. And she spoke out against everything. She just spoke her mind, and she pleaded for war to be avoided with both of her godparents. One was the Kaiser and the other one was Edward VII. Neither listened to her. Anyway, Daisy, after the war, had really fallen out with her husband because of his attitude. And he became more German than the Germans. And he was writing letters to Daisy at the end of the war saying, I cannot wait to see Paris razed to the ground. And, you know, if I met one of your relations, I'd have them shot. So not surprisingly, it was a bit difficult for them to get back together again after that. But nevertheless, the Pless family were probably one of the richest families, maybe the richest family in Germany. So Daisy got a kind of deal from her husband where he said, you can have this and you can have that and you can have that. And she had already begun to have. She didn't realise it. She just felt very tired, and then she was in a wheelchair and she didn't know what was wrong with her. But she did have the approach of MS. But what happened was, after the First World War, Silesia was carved up. Part of it was given to Poland. The Plesses lost the rights to all their great estates. The Poles took over. And suddenly her munificent husband, although curiously enough he still had the money to keep 24 powdered footmen around his table, had not a halfpenny for his poor wife, who ended up living in a kind of room over the gatehouse in one of his castles, looked after by a rather splendid English woman who'd looked after her mother in England, who came out to Germany simply to look after Daisy and see her through. Poor Daisy, and she'd not only got no money, so she was writing the memoirs really to keep herself alive and to keep food on the table, but she also had her son Hansel, her adored boy, sitting in Brixton prison.
God, she was hard done by, wasn't she?
It's terrible. It's a tragic story.
And then Daisy's grave, what happened to that?
That was a dreadful story because, well, of course, the Russians came in at the end of the war, as we know, into Germany. And when they marched towards where Daisy had been living, her grave was dug up and her body was dug up. And I mean, to me, more awful than that. It was just gangs run wild. They didn't care who was who. It was just a world run mad. I mean, Germany, there are wonderful books written about and terrifying books. Germany after the war, absolutely lawless. There was no money. Anybody could do whatever they wanted. Gosh. And it was absolute chaos and terror. Yeah. And so Daisy's body was dug up. And more pathetically to me, her faithful maid, Dolly Crowther, who was by then 70, set off bravely to try and get to the Allied zone, but she never made it. She was caught by the Russians on the way and murdered and left by the side of the road, and her body was never discovered. Oh. It's so sad.
Now we go on to a lady whose name I find very hard to pronounce, Mechtilde.
Ah, Mechtilde Lichnowsky. She's a great heroine throughout, in a way. She was the aunt I discovered, to my huge delight, of my German aunt, my Aunt Nutschi. And it turned out that she was the niece of the wonderful Mechtilde, about whom I knew absolutely nothing when I began this book. Yeah. Mechtilde herself was like her sister, Countess Harrach, very, very artistic, but actually far more brilliant. And she was described by a great Austrian called Karl Kraus as the most brilliant spirit in German writing. Of men and women, she was the most brilliant of them all. Wonderful writer, completely untranslated. We know nothing about her here. And also a great, great art patron. She collected people like Kokoschka and Picasso before they'd ever been heard of. And where she comes into the story is that her husband, Karl Marx Lichnowsky, was sent over by the Kaiser, his old friend Karl Marx. He hoped to heal the breach between England and Germany on the eve of war. So Karl Marx, who was tremendously Anglophile, was sent over as Germany's ambassador to England. And he adored the English, as did Mechtilde. And they lived at the German embassy, which was then on the Mall, just below Buckingham Palace. And there's the most poignant account of when they were told that war had broken out, and Karl Marx burst into tears, and Mechtilde was desolate and was found by Daisy Pless wandering around Green Park crying and just unable to believe the end of their lives and their beloved England. Mechtilde was found by Daisy Pless wandering, weeping through Green Park, unable to believe that she and her husband were going to have to leave their beloved England. And that day, the Prussian eagle was torn down from the front of the embassy. But in fact, the Brits did very well by Karl Marx and his wife. I mean, they were very conscious that these were innocents abroad who loved their country. And poor Karl Marx wrote the most heartbreaking account of them being given this kind of guard of honour to see them off down to the ship crossing over to France. And he wept the whole way. And then he got back to Germany and he saw all the troop trains coming past and all the young boys with the flowers garlanding their necks, their mothers hung round them, and he just burst into tears all over again. And Mechthilde, strangely, what happened with her was that years before she had known Karl Marx, she had met and been enchanted by a young Englishman. And years later, Karl Marx died in 1929. And Mechthilde, who'd always loved England and was welcome back here, came back to England in 1934 and married her young Englishman and lived blissfully with him in England until, alack and alas, in 1939. I find this story happening over and over again with German women in England. She thought, I must go back and see my son in Germany for one last time. But she went at just the wrong timing and the doors slammed shut. And she was an exile in Germany, unable to return to her very ill husband who died in her absence.
Of course,
completely under the surveillance of the Gestapo. And it was just a desperately sad story. But she did nevertheless end up coming back to England and living a rather happy bohemian life in Hampstead, where she was great friends with people like Elias Canetti and so on, and died here and is buried in Weybridge.
Wow. But it's incredible how literally these wars, you know, we all feel sorry for like the young men that go and get killed and you hear about this, but this is about families, about people and their hearts and their lives are being torn apart.
Really, that's the theme of my book. And I mean, two particularly poignant cases to me. There's one of a wonderful family called the Schroeders, who were, as one can tell from the name, German, but had settled in England. And poor Bruno Schroeder in the First World War, he collected orchids and loved them. And his beautiful greenhouses with the orchids in were all smashed because they said he's a German, he's hoarding coal. And then he was hauled up to explain himself and told that he must decide whether he was German or English. And he said, I can't. It's as though my parents have quarrelled. How can I choose between the two? Another very poignant case was a wonderful woman who'd been born Hilda de Bunsen. And again, as one can tell, the name was originally German, but they'd married English people and were completely Anglo-German. Well, Hilda herself had married two German husbands, while her brother, Morris, had been sent off to Vienna as England's ambassador out to Vienna, so the family had gone two ways. And poor Hilda, during the war, while her German son was imprisoned in Germany, was living in London, running a household where, and this really struck me, every morning she would call her household down to prayers. She was very religious and say, now, shall we pray for the poor dear Kaiser this morning, or shall we pray for the poor dear King? And they would choose between the two because they felt equally allied to both.
Now, what about Countess Teresa Schulenburg? What can you tell us about her?
Countess Teresa Schulenburg is a wonderful character. And, well, she was the daughter of a rather famous plotter who was eventually very brutally killed on Hitler's orders because of his part in the 20th of July plot. That was
Teresa. The one that was made into a film, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So that was Teresa's father.
Mm-hmm.
Teresa grew up in a beautiful house up in Mecklenburg and was brought up in a very sort of laid-back, bohemian, aristocratic way that I became very familiar with in this book, where, you know, everybody spoke English and German. They were at home in England as they were in Germany. Teresa, when she was about 19, she wanted to be an artist. She ran off to Berlin, where I gather she was extremely naughty. I had the use of her unpublished memoirs, and she keeps saying, I will draw a veil. And you think, ooh, I wonder what was happening then. Quite a lot, I think. Anyway, she married a tremendously charming, jolly a man called Fritz Hess, who was Jewish. Teresa herself was officially a communist, but she was the kind of communist who saw no difficulty about the fact that she lived in an enormous house stuffed with Rembrandts and Van Dycks, but she would wander off and sort of mix with the communists and then go back to her private gym and do a little exercise. Anyway, in 1933, Fritz Hess, as a Jew, had to leave Germany and came to England, and Teresa came with him. And Teresa in England, I think she was very lost at first for what to do. Teresa's brother, Fritz Dietloff, was the only member of her family who had not turned Nazi, and he was the one who was later involved in the great plot against Hitler. But Teresa had no idea, because you couldn't talk about that sort of thing in Germany. It was to risk your life. So she thought all of her family were Nazi. She was living in England with not a lot to do and feeling rather wistful and cut off. And she went to a series of little art studios where Henry Moore was working, and he encouraged her to start sculpting. And Tisa turned out to be a remarkably talented sculptress. She became the most famous sculpting nun in Germany. But while she was living in England, she wanted to do good. She felt that she must do something for people. It's the last relic of her communist days, I suppose. So she went up in her fur coats and pearls up to Durham to work with the Durham miners at a time. This was, you know, a time of complete unemployment and terrible poverty of a kind that Tisa had never seen before. And she arrived armed with lots of very nice colour plates of, you know, various things like Van Gogh, and showed them to the miners, who were polite but puzzled. And Tisa went away feeling a complete failure. But she was a very plucky woman, and she said, no, I've got to give this another go. I realise I got it wrong. I'll go back and I'll teach them how to sculpt. And in fact, it was a tremendous success story. The miners thought of her as a sort of bohemian pet, and there she always was in the pearls and the wonderful fur hat and the fur coat and everything, but also very chummy and sweet and unfull of airs, teaching them all how to sculpt. Mm-hmm. And Tisa was planning to spend her life doing that. She and Fritz are grown apart. But it's again a story a little bit like Mechtilde Lichnowsky, where her parents became ill in Germany, and Tisa heard that even though they were Nazi, they were dying, and she felt, I've got to go and pay one last visit. Mm-hmm. And what happened was she came back there. Mm. She did hear from her brother Fritz that he actually was against the Nazis, so she had one ally in the family. But when she got back to Croydon Airport from her father's funeral, the English wouldn't let her in.
Oh my God.
There was a very, very stubborn customs man there, and he said, you're getting back on that plane and you're going back to Germany. And everybody came down from every kind of organisation and said, but you know, this is wonderful teaser and we all love her and she must stay here. And the customs man said, no. She's going back. Okay. So back poor old Tisa went to Germany, and she spent her war with her sister living in a house that would house refugees and people on the run. And there's a wonderful account in her book of when the glamorous Stauffenberg of the plot came to stay for a night with her brother, and they all laughed and talked about English poetry and sang songs all night. And it sounds actually rather glamorous, but you feel she's brushing over an awful lot of pain and anguish.
Mm. And what happened to her husband?
What happened to Fritz Hess? Well, it's one of those stories where Tisa's capacity for many love affairs took over, I think. Oh. She'd already pretty much split up with Fritz Hess before she left for Germany. And in Germany, she actually found another husband quite quickly with a rather nice house near to her sister-in-law, married him, looked after his estate while he went off to the war, and turned his house into this kind of refuge. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the war came over, the husband came back and found that Tisa had been having many, many, many delightful affairs. And that was the end of that marriage. And Tisa then took this extraordinary and unexpected turn where she went off into one of the most brutally deprived bits of Germany and somewhere where nobody would want to live, and joined a very, very, very stern order of nuns. And that was where she lived for the rest of her life. And she was the first woman to do a sculpture of the Holocaust.
Wow.
An extraordinary woman who should definitely be written about more, I think.
Miranda Seymour, it's been amazing talking today. Just a few more questions. Thank you so much. It's all about your book. But do you think that we still are, you've done this whole book, do you think that we are still linked to Germany, though, in a way?
Certainly when I've been to Germany myself, I found, and I've heard this from so many people I've talked to who aren't German, they say it almost like a kind of secret society, that they felt at home in a way that's really hard to explain. You just feel comfortable there. Even if it isn't your first language, there's a kind of ease there. And I think that for younger people, there's no problem at all. I mean, I know lots of people between 20 and 30 who now live in Berlin, and they're English, and they have no hang-up, and the Germans have no hang-up. The problem, I think, remains with the older generation, probably my own generation.
Hear the war stories.
Yes, yeah. And I find it incredibly sad that one of the main characters in my book, Herbert Sulzbach, who was a Jew who came over from Germany, fought in the Second World War, then worked with Nazis over here, kind of re-educating them to see the error of their ways and actually being incredibly effective. And as long ago as 1984, Sulzbach went on television to say that he saw hope ahead, but first the old distrust must disappear. And I think that in 2013, the old distrust is still there, and that's why I've written this book.
Well, let's hope that Noble Endeavours changes people's views and minds. Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous today.
It's been a complete pleasure. Thank you so much, Josephine.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling? RadioGorgeous.com.